Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Guys, I've got a question for you. I just got my sandwiches out of the bag, and they're making a funny noise. Do you want to have a listen? Do you think there's something wrong with them? Hello, listeners. Welcome to Park Date. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. Something a bit special for you. This is a chat that I recorded with someone who I really love, a great and talented individual based in Birmingham. We talked because I had the crazy idea to do a series about Telly Savalas Looks at Birmingham, the short film that I'm obsessed with, the Harold Baim film, which we still might do. If you're interested, let me know. But in the meantime, I thought I would put this chat out as part of Park Date because it's really interesting and I love what this guy does. And we talked in the park as well, so it is relevant, I promise you. The person who I'm going to talk to in this episode is Andy Howlett. Andy directed a great movie called Paradise Lost, which looked at the story of Birmingham Central Library, the brutalist behemoth that I am obsessed with, that featured in my novel, The Wall in the Head. And Andy's film, Paradise Lost, is something that you should check out. So we talked about that, and we talked about Flannery, psychogeography, extreme noticing, and some other cool stuff, skateboarding as well. Thank you, Andy, for joining me for this chat, and I hope you enjoy this slightly different episode. If you do, leave us a review. Best review wins a prize, you know that. Follow us on socials at Park Date Podcast. Enjoy this episode. So I'm here with Andy Howlett in Kings Heath Park on a nice sunny day. We've been saying this is the first day that we could come and have a walk without winter coats.
It's not quite cherry blossom season yet, like
I love that,
like when Telly visited.
Very good reference.
But it's getting there.
It's getting there, isn't it? Yeah, he's very taken by the cherry blossom, isn't he? In where's that? Is it in Cannon Hill Park? I'm not sure.
Or Bourneville.
Bourneville, isn't it? Which we're quite near to. But yeah, it's a film that I've always found interesting. Andy, you made a film about Paradise Circus, and we were just looking at the book, the Paradise book that's just come out, talking about that area. I think one of the things that's interesting about Telly Savalas Looks at Birmingham is it captures that point in time, in the, I think it's 1981, 1980 when it was released, where the kind of post-war city had been completed, really. They'd built all the ring road, which they talk about a lot, and lots of the office buildings, to create that kind of complete vision of Birmingham, including of course the library and Paradise Circus. And then fast forward 30 years, and that city that was created is then being taken apart. And that's the story that you tell, really, isn't it, of the post-war utopian city then being kind of, we've sort of lost faith in it, and people are looking at it in a different way.
Yeah, I was struck by the images in the film, just re-watching the clip that's on YouTube and how sort of sparkling and clean it all looked. Yeah. And like the shot of the Five Ways roundabout, I just couldn't believe it. I was there the other day and it's so kind of scrappy and forlorn looking now, but it looked just really smooth and shiny. And so, yeah, I think that was in like the early 80s, which was actually quite late in the in that period. Like you say, it had all been completed, but it was really the 60s when most of that redevelopment was happening. But it was still looking pretty fresh in the 80s as well.
There's a nice crash zoom, isn't there, when they're looking at Five Ways, I seem to remember.
Yeah, and the islands over the Aston Expressway as well. And just how trim and neat it all looked. Like the lawns really, you know, those places, what remains of them today are kind of a bit more overgrown, and which I quite like. That has its own charm to it, like they've grown into themselves. But yeah, so that version of the city, that post-war concrete paradise or hellhole, whichever way you look at it, was a version of the city I never really knew myself, because I grew up in Solihull, which is just far enough away from Birmingham to not really need to go in very often, because you've got all your everything you need in Solihull. So the, you know, the odd time I did come in, I didn't see very much. It was on school trips or picking my granny up from the coach station, and I'd have glimpses. I'd see like the rotunda towering up, and it, I remember the sense of awe seeing that, and it, I had this idea of Birmingham as quite a frightening, intimidating metropolis that, you know, over there, that I wouldn't go to often. And by the time I did start coming into the city centre, when I was old enough to go, you know, shopping with friends and skateboarding even, the reconstruction was already underway. So one of my first memories of coming into the city centre with friends was a huge hole in the ground where the old bullring used to be. So I don't remember what it was like as a shopping centre. I just remember a hole in the ground. And so, yeah, I don't have a memory of that old modernist city. I only really know it from photos and films. And so I think the one of the reasons I got so fascinated by Paradise Circus and the old library was it was like this final island of that that version
last,
of
the last bit that remained.
Yeah, the last substantial bit of it. There are still little, you know, bits here and there, but that was the last big, you know, significant piece. So it was just fascinating to walk around like what felt like an alien kind of civilization almost, and just try and figure out what is this? What? Because it was such a strange place, quite bewildering on all different levels and all the different walkways and places that didn't go anywhere, lots of dead ends and stairways to nowhere and that sort of thing. It was just fascinating to walk around and try and figure it out and like imagine when the whole city centre was like that.
Yeah.
Just this big confusing concrete place and all the different levels and
the Paradise Circus for me, I was also really intrigued to explore it and see the dead ends and to see all the levels and the fences and the gates, and you know, you try and find your way in and you can't find your way out. And I remember there was like this whole kind of Dickensian
underworld almost happening there, like people living there and foxes and I think in the film you there's a bit, isn't there, where you manage to like get from the Undercroft back up into the library building, which is something I'd always wondered if it was possible to do that. But yeah, I think the way that the city's kind of presented on film is really interesting. And with the Telly Savalas Looks at Birmingham, you have this one view of this almost, you know, utopian city in the sun, where the ring road is a really great asset, and you know, everyone's loving the views and everyone's loving just hanging out in the parks, which is actually an interesting version of the city's story, I think, because we often kind of see this like dystopian past, don't we? Like, oh, we had to live in these tower blocks and go under subways all the time. But actually, you see people just having their normal lives and doing stuff. I think when I was writing my novel, The Wall in the Head, I was thinking about the two things of like the extreme weirdness that you would find in places like Paradise Circus, but also the normality, right? Of just people doing normal things. You talk about skateboarders a lot, don't you? People just, like skateboarders, just using those places as kind of hangout zones and stuff. Do you think skateboarders kind of colonized the places that people then stopped wanting to go to, didn't they? When people were kind of scared to go to Paradise Circus, the skateboarders were like, well, we'll take that. We'll take that zone.
Yeah, there are like competing narratives about what the city was like back then. Like, was it this utopian paradise, or was it a hellish concrete jungle? I'm not sure that binaries like that are very helpful, really.
It's more nuanced, isn't it?
Yeah, and speaking as someone who didn't actually experience that version of the city very much, it's not, you know, I can't say for sure firsthand, but you can look at different sources and try and figure out, right, read between the lines. And an interesting contrast, I think, to the Telly Savalas film is there's one that I found doing the research for my film when I went to the media archive in Lincoln. There was a film made, it must have been about 10 years before, like in the early 70s, and with another television personality whose name escapes me. I should have looked it up before coming out, but it was a comedian, a northern comedian, who I think would have been very well known back then, but isn't remembered so much now. And so he comes and visits Birmingham and looks at a lot of the same places that Telly Savalas looks at in the city centre and the Ring Road and the Bull Ring, but he has the opposite opinion. He's walking around like, oh, what a shithole. This is horrendous. And he's really scathing about the post-war planning. He sees it as being inhuman, and that the people have been subordinated to cars and are being channeled into horrible subways and losing their freedom. They can't choose where to walk freely. They're forced into these tunnels and subways. And his take on it is that it was the sort of middle class elite planners and architects who lived in the leafy suburbs. They were making the decisions about how the rest of the Brummies, the working population, were going to live, the places that they were going to spend their time in the city centre. Yeah. And he says, oh, the people of Birmingham are an industrious people and a creative people. They should be able to build their own city, or, you know, design their own city, which is a nice take.
Yeah,
I think
we'll have to dig that film out for sure, and I'll give that one a watch. I think that point's really, really interesting, and one of the things that I love about your film, Andy, is that you talk about John Maydin, who was the Birmingham architect who built a lot of these modernist buildings in Birmingham. And I think his story is very, very interesting. We were just looking in the Paradise book. You see a picture of him with a model of the civic centre of the city that he wanted to build. The library, not everyone knows, the library is only a small portion of what he wanted to achieve, to build this whole kind of brutalist kind of civic centre with lots of different elements and lots of walkways and things like that. And in fact, you talk as well, don't you, about how it was only partially finished. It was supposed to have these water gardens, could have looked like the Barbican, could have been very, very, very nice environment that everyone would have loved to go to, and maybe it would have survived longer if they'd have finished those parts of the library complex. But yeah, I love the way you tell John Maydin's story in your film. Catherine O'Flynn kind of talks about this fictional architect which is based on him as well, and you know, this idea that he was obviously trying to create a future, but was it the right future, and how in touch was he with what people wanted? But his story, I think, is part of that whole kind of new Birmingham, isn't it? Were you kind of drawn to talking about John and like what he wanted to achieve and having that element to it in your film?
Yeah, absolutely. I was struck by the contrasts actually between John Maydin and Herbert Manzoni, yeah, who was the city engineer for decades and was really responsible for the most of the post-war rebuilding, and so he had a final say on
it. Manzoni was kind of Maydin's boss, right?
Yeah, basically, and so they were friends, and they worked together on a lot, but they actually had very different outlooks on planning and architecture and making a place. So Manzoni, he was the one who really loved cars and thought that just, you know, plough these huge urban motorways through the city, that's what we need, and the cars are the future, and so pedestrians became a bit of an afterthought, and he really wasn't that interested in aesthetics or architecture or history, even, mm-hmm, you know, having visible links to the past. There was a famous quote where he said he sees little value in having any visible links to the past. Yeah. We should be looking forward. So quite a
motto, of course,
yes,
isn't it? Forward.
Yes, of course. So quite a crude approach, really. Whereas John Maydin really had a sensitivity to what had come before, and that he would design his buildings with the surrounding landscape in mind. So he wasn't just about having a clean slate. It was like, okay, what's already here? The trees, the buildings, and he would try and make what he was building sensitive to that. So with the scale of his buildings, the materials he used. And that's true with the Central Library itself. The original materials he wanted it to be clad in would be like Portland stone or travertine marble, which was chosen to complement the civic buildings that were already there in that place. And he the scale of the building, he didn't want it to be too high, that it would dwarf the buildings around it. So he really he had that sensitivity to his surroundings, which is often overlooked. I think there's this view that modernists just didn't care about that. They were just had contempt for anything that came before, which there was some of that, certainly. So I found that very interesting, that these two very different versions of modernism, and sadly it was the cruder version that won out, that had the final say in the reconstruction of Birmingham. And the film toys with the idea of what if, you know, Maiden, his that more sensitive approach to modernism had in fact been the main driving force. What, you know, would it have worked out differently? Would we now be a city of concrete lovers? Would we be proud of our concrete towers and things like that? Yeah.
I think that's a really, really interesting point. And I like how you talk about that idea in the film, Andy. And it's something that I've thought about as well. I wonder if, I mean, we're talking about the Paradise book that just came out last week, wasn't it? He said it was sold out launch for that. There's been lots of interest in your film. I was writing about, I feel like when I started writing a bit about brutalism and modernism maybe a decade ago, it was sort of seen as being a bit weird, but actually now it's kind of mainstream. Like, you look at Instagram, everyone loves brutalist architecture and people pay a fortune to live in the Barbican. You can't help but wonder if maybe Birmingham has made a little bit of a mistake by demolishing something which could have actually been a landmark for the city, a tourist attraction. They could have changed it into something else. I remember speaking to Alan Clawley, who you talked to as well, didn't you? He was an amazing guy who campaigned for the library, and he showed me ideas that some architecture students had proposed, where they could turn it into a regional assembly or a music venue or a hotel, or all these kind of different ways to do stuff. Obviously, we now know in this era when we think about climate change that demolishing all these buildings is supremely wasteful than just to build new buildings in their place. So I feel like in a few years that idea of demolishing everything will suddenly become quite toxic, maybe. So yeah, it is one of those great what if questions. And if they'd have had the water gardens there, it would have looked a lot more kind of superficially attractive to people as well, so that might have won it more plaudits. But I think it's interesting when you look at the Telly Savalas film, like, things do look very neat and they all work well. It doesn't look like too horrible, you know. There is maybe this parallel timeline where we could have had the city looking like that, but maybe made different changes to make it more accessible to people. Maybe less steps, so people could kind of get around those spaces more easily. But I think also with the idea of demolishing things, of demolitions, we need some kind of record, don't we, of what things look like and what they did look like. And with this film, I love to the Telly Savalas film. I love to see what parts of the city looked like that aren't there anymore. And with your film as well, it captures elements of Paradise Circus and of the library which we can't see anymore now. I've talked about this to you before, haven't I, this idea of like it being a document that maybe kids in the future could look at and say, wow, this is a part of the city that we don't see anymore. But were you kind of consciously thinking about like making something, like using film as almost a historical tool, or was that something that just kind of happened as you were making the film?
Yeah, I was conscious of that, because Birmingham's a city that's just always reinventing itself, yeah, and has this history of just being very cavalier about its history and yeah, not really interested in preserving things. And as we mentioned, the motto "Forward."
Yeah.
And as such, that yeah, records of past versions of the city are quite scant, and but you know, when you do find something, it's like this amazing, like treasure, like, bit of treasure. It's yeah, like this window into this past version of the city, and so I did become very interested in just tracking down any kind of historical piece of media or book or you know, anything created in the city that is a document of a certain time. And so I was aware of my own film as being...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
A document like that. I do quite like that. You know, although it has its downsides, the city just constantly bulldozing the past, and it does feel like you've found something special when you do find these traces and clues and connections to people who have come before you. I'm not sure where I was going with that.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And we talked about you know, when you were looking in the media archives, when I was writing my book, The Wall in the Head, I was constantly watching any archive footage I could get my hands on, and also things like local news and local TV programs, where you get these different visions of the city and different versions of the city as well. And it seems to me like film is a really good way to bring that to life, right? It's part of the archive, and then it becomes part of the conversation, really. So even when these places don't exist, we can watch a film of how they used to look. I was talking also about Take Me High recently. Are you familiar with that?
I am.
Where that shows another kind of view of this utopian concrete city. Mm. In fact, one of Cliff's songs is called Concrete City, and it's very celebratory of that kind of new Birmingham, isn't it?
Mm.
I guess there was a lot of films like that back in that back in that era. Were there any kind of other of those that inspired you to think, I want to make a film about Paradise Circus in particular? Or was it maybe other, you know, we were talking about psychogeography, weren't we? Is there any other films in that genre that you were kind of inspired by when you were thinking about making yours?
Yeah, definitely. Not so much Birmingham films, but like the work of Patrick Keeler, for instance, where, so London, the first film, first feature film, which is entirely made up of just static shots of very mundane scenes, streets and parks and places around London, and just with people walking about, going about their day, and there are no actors or anything. It's all told through narration and telling the story of a series of walks that the protagonist Robinson goes on, and this mix of the sort of quotidian, like describing the sort of local council politics and what it's like to go into a supermarket, and then in the next breath talking about the history of like these radical art movements, or the romantic poets who would just reimagine spaces as sort of utopian places full of possibility, and that really struck me, the way that the film doesn't make a distinction between the mundane and the magical. It's like the mundane is the magical. It's all one. And so I definitely had an idea of, like, you know, giving Birmingham that treatment. Like, Birmingham it deserves a sort of feature-length kind of psychogeographical study. And the Central Library became like the perfect focal point for that, I felt. And also, another good Birmingham example is the Jonathan Meads.
Jonathan Meads, I was just thinking that as well.
Comes to Birmingham.
Yeah.
He was another one, very much ahead of his time in terms of celebrating brutalism and modernism. He was like in the 90s, he was singing the praises of like brutalist tower blocks and the Birmingham Ring Road, which was so unheard of then. He was very much in a niche, all of his own, as far as I can tell.
That's my favourite Jonathan Meads film, Heart Bypass, when he the one about Birmingham. It's also very, very funny, which I think is a great thing. I love the way he uses humour. He has that like Palestinian rock band playing on a roundabout in the Ring Road, and then he's driving around the Ring Road with that radio WM DJ. Is it Les Ross? I think something like that. He's telling a joke about a Brummy lorry driver. But yeah, again, the mixture of the mundane and the magical, I think, is a very, very powerful. Very powerful one. I love those Patrick Keeler films so much too. The follow-ups as well, Robinson in Ruins and Robinson in Space, are great, aren't they? And they're always following and alluding to great writers, which I guess you kind of do, don't you, in Paradise as well, like thinking about like Paradise Lost and how that's kind of irrelevant as well. But yeah, I think those two things can mix well together. But it's important as well, isn't it, to show a couple of keep pugs coming up to us. It's important to show the daily life occurring, right? Like, life isn't all kind of the Tom Cruise glamour of Mission Impossible, which is shot in Birmingham quite recently, I believe, wasn't it? The latest one. But also just people going about their business.
I tried to show the everyday life of Paradise Circus, and in fact spoke to people who used to call that place home, like the skateboarders
and librarians.
Yeah, and people who enjoyed the subways, the hated subways, and
I thought that was fascinating. Yeah, the women you spoke to who really liked the subways, and then I didn't even realise there was a campaign to keep them open, wasn't there? And people were doing a little kind of get together type thing. And
not so much a campaign, just a celebration.
A celebration
by having a little festival.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
exactly.
Bringing to life this bit of public space and showing, look, you can just use this space to do whatever you want.
Exactly. When we watch Telly Savalas Looks at Birmingham, we see acres and acres of public space. We see a lot of parks and subways. Like whether they worked or not is obviously another discussion, but there's a lot of public space, and within Paradise Circus and the library, that was all public space. And one of the things you talk about now is that transition, isn't it, to private space, how the city's really been privatised. So is it almost, you know, this conversation about the city not working, is that maybe a Trojan horse in a way for people who've got a financially vested interest to say, well, actually, we want to rebuild the city in our vision. While we're at it, we can make quite a lot of money out of it.
Yeah. Wouldn't want to use the Trojan horse.
Maybe not here. Maybe that was the wrong, wrong choice of words for here.
Other associations.
But, exactly.
But definitely. I mean, there absolutely were real problems with how the city had been rebuilt in the 60s and... real problems that needed to be addressed, but that absolutely was used as a smokescreen, let's say.
That's a use of words, yeah.
By developers and people who saw an opportunity for land grab, really. Yeah. Like, well, we can make this weird, ugly part of the city work if you hand it over to us. We'll pay for all the upkeep of it and have security guards and CCTV, make sure it stays looking pristine. So it's the Brinley Place model. But that brings with it its whole new set of issues and problems, the sense that as citizens, we don't really own our city anymore, that we're constantly wondering, like, am I allowed to be here? What am I allowed to do here? Mm. Am I allowed to cycle? Am I allowed to skateboard? Can I start singing a song? Or am I going to... Can I fall asleep?
Yeah.
Or will I be approached by security and carted off? And it's often not clear what parts of the city are privately owned and which parts are public.
Yeah.
There's no requirement to have it marked out, have it spelt out. There might be small little indicators, like a little sign saying, this is not a public highway. Or sometimes bollards are used to mark the distinction between, like around the Bullring, for instance, the Bullring owned space will be on one side of the bollards, and then the public street will be on the other side, and it just means you're constantly living in this state of uncertainty. Like you don't really know what your rights are in any given space, and so naturally you tend to err on the side of caution and think, oh, I better not draw any suspicion, or I don't want any confrontations with the authorities. And that's not good. I don't want to be feeling like that all the time. I want to see the city as a place of possibility and where we can express ourselves and have a role in shaping it in some way and bringing life to it.
Do you think if Harold Baim and Telly Savalas were making the film today, they'd obviously be looking at different things. Do you think there would be that sense of optimism that we had back then? Do you think, how do you feel about the city today? Do you feel kind of optimistic about the way it's going? I guess you always have, there's always pros and cons, isn't there? We see like that privatisation of space and quite, honestly, quite a lot of bad architecture going up in the city. But then you also see quite a lot of innovation and kind of, we were talking, weren't we, about like the arts. There's quite a lot of creative people here. So I guess that's the flip side, isn't it? You have like that as kind of a positive. Do you feel like a sense of kind of optimism though?
Not really, to be honest, but I don't think I would have done back then either.
Really?
I think that the Telly Savalas film feels like marketing to me, which brings up the question of who commissioned it, why was it made, but it feels like a marketer's kind of image of this is what we want to sell to the world. But I'm sure I would have found it quite absurd if I'd been around at the time and seen that. And you could make a film just like that now, kind of celebrating the mundane things, like look at all the shiny buildings and what a great place to be. So I think it's all spin, really. But there definitely are good things to celebrate in the city. Like the arts scene and the music scene, things like that. But it often feels like that stuff happens in spite of the powers that be, like the council, and rather than because of it. It doesn't feel like that is valued by the people in charge of running the city, and that people really have to fight to make good stuff happen. And it feels like it's a constant battle. And like, for instance, the heavy metal stuff, like Birmingham's the birthplace of heavy metal, which is a global phenomenon, a huge industry worldwide, and the city seems to have no interest in marking that or celebrating that. Like, where's the heavy metal museum? Now there is the Home of Metal. People have done great work celebrating this heritage with exhibitions and bringing the members of Black Sabbath to the to the city to but again that was kind of a grassroots thing by a small group of people, and it really seems like the council haven't been supportive of that and haven't recognised the value of that by creating some sort of permanent exhibition. Or
it would be great, wouldn't it? I remember talking to Lisa Mayer and the Capsule people quite a lot when I lived here, and I always loved all the stuff they did, and I think the Home of Metal stuff that they've done has been really phenomenal. But one of the conversations around that, as you mentioned, was the possibility of having a permanent museum of heavy metal. And in fact, one of the venues touted for that was the library at one stage. So
it would have been perfect.
It would have been perfect, exactly. That's what probably should have happened, rather than knocking it down. And just to finish, Andy, I guess I just wanted to ask you as well, firstly, if you're going to make another film about Birmingham, and secondly, so many dogs in the park. If your views of the city changed when you were making the film, or if you kind of learned anything, or it kind of changed your mind about Birmingham when you made your film.
It's a good question. In terms of making more films about Birmingham, I think I will. I think there's more here that I'd like to dig into. So heavy metal being one of those things, that's one part of the city's history that I'm very interested in, and you know, big fan of the genre, so I'd like to do something with that. There's also the Birmingham Surrealists, so Conroy Maddox, Desmond Morris, who went on to find fame as a TV presenter presenting like animal and nature programs, but he had this double life as a surrealist artist. That's a whole kind of like hidden history that I'd like to dig into. And I've always liked the idea of making a time travel film. I just find the whole concept fascinating, like all the paradoxes and the potentials for alternate timelines splitting off. And I think a city would be a great kind of subject for that. Like, what if you could travel back to different eras of the city, or what if you could go to parallel versions of the city where things worked out differently? So I explore that a bit in Paradise Lost, where I find the
what would portal. Happen if it was exactly
what if the utopian ideals of John Maiden's original Paradise vision had been realised, what might that look like? So that's something I'd like to explore more fully. So, yeah, maybe a Birmingham time travel film
that sounds perfect.
On the horizon.
I think you should make that. I'll be first in line to buy a ticket. Excellent. Okay.
I don't know about the other question. My thoughts on the city have changed. I don't know. I think my brain's reached its limit now. I can't really.
We'll stop for now. We'll have a little walk around the park. Andy, thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of Park Date. There's lots more where that came from, and there'll be more in the future as well. If you enjoyed it, please leave a review, good or bad, make them funny. I'll be reading out the best ones, and there'll be a prize for the one that makes me laugh the most. Name check some trees in your reviews and leave them wherever you get your podcasts from. Check out our website, parkdate.co.uk, and if you see me walking around in the park, come and say hello. I think that was the sound of someone sneezing. Yes. Thank you. Bye-bye. On the next episode of Park Date, join me and Dame Maggie Smith as we take a nude walk on a park date through the Englischer Garten in Munich. It will be a park date that no one around us will ever forget.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.